Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated March 11th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. On the front page, top of the fold, NC's only ethanol producer, Flickering, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. With gasoline prices on the rise and talk of a revival of the corn-based ethanol industry in the air, the $100 million-plus venture Clean Burn Fuels, North Carolina's sole ethanol producer, may not survive to reach the new day. In a March 2nd internal memo to key investors and vendors, the company says it is suspending production at its Rayford plant near Fayetteville, at least temporarily. The cause is a run-up in the price of corn that's left the firm facing additional operating losses of $1.5 million a month. This cash burn is unsustainable, the memo says. Clean Burn Fuels is losing money on every gallon of ethanol it produces. Meanwhile, company executives and board members have been meeting with investors and banks in an attempt to sketch out a new financing plan. Obviously, we're going to have to capitalize the company to sustain it, says Board Chairman Kirk J. Bradley, a Sanford Oil Company executive, developer of Governor's Club, and an early Clean Burn investor. We are trying to evaluate all the options. And our intent is to try and find a way to survive. Bradley says the evaluation period is expected to take up to 30 days. He could not provide an estimate for when ethanol production would resume at the 500-acre distillery in Hope County. Ironically, the manufacturing halt comes as Clean Burn was achieving production milestones. As of February 20th, according to the memo, the facility had reached nameplate or rated production of 162,850 gallons for the first time. Since that time, production on most days has been right around nameplate, with a few variances. So the plant has proven itself mechanically as designed, the memo says. It was an A list of Triangle investors, including Capital Broadcasting Company President Jim Goodman and Jeff Monsine of the Aluminum Company of North Carolina, and a syndicate of 15 banks and other lenders that put up an estimated $103 million back in 2008 to build and staff the Clean Burn operation. Fayetteville-based Cape Fear Farm Credit took the lead banking role in the deal, putting together a $60 million package, including $10 million in loans and $25 million in loan guarantees from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Attempts to reach Cape Fear Farm Credit interim CEO Michael Jackson for an update were not successful. The facility started making ethanol in August 2010. About that same time, according to U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission documents, Clean Burn CEO Jack Carlisle went back out to the private investor market with a stock offering. With an ultimate fundraising target of $10 million, the company had pulled in only half that amount by November, according to the documents. Clean Burn's manufacturing suspension is coming at a time when some idled West Coast ethanol plants are coming out of mothballs to take advantage of new conditions, including rising gasoline prices. Ethanol, or alcohol, is sold as an additive to gasoline. Various blends of the mixture can range anywhere from 10 cents to 50 cents per gallon less than regular gas. Sue Retke-Schill, editor of Grand Forks, North Dakota-based Ethanol Producer magazine, which tracks the industry and the nation's 220 manufacturing plants, says the recent run-up in gasoline prices has yet to work a significant alteration in ethanol economics. Margins, once favorable, are still tight at many plants. Moreover, she says a number of facilities built in the 2008-2009 time period, as was Clean Burn, when ramp-up costs were higher, have been facing hard times as corn prices have risen. They are the ones that seem to be caught in the squeeze, she says. We have seen problems at a number of them as they struggle to make the numbers work. It's true, she adds, that some once-idled California ethanol producers are now reopening, but they are also taking advantage of that state's carbon fuel standard, which increases the demand for multiple fuels. As for the rest of the country, the reality of higher corn prices is still working against an industry revival. Corn per bushel at $3.90 in 2009 hit $5.15 in 2010, according to the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. It's been steep, Jack Burke of the North Carolina Biofuel Center says of the price increase. Corn prices have been going up faster than gas prices. Burke, whose agency keeps track of new alternative energy projects in the state, says none of the ethanol area have raised their heads above the corn rows since the arrival of Rayford's clean burn fuels. Next up, to ACC Brass, March is Cash, by Chris Basden. From Greensboro, March is money time for Atlantic Coast Conference sponsors, who will be out in full promotional force with advertisements, in-game contests, and FanFest activities at the 2011 Men's Basketball Tournament in Greensboro. But the real action from a business perspective will tip off in the weeks after the games are over. That's when as much as $20 million in annual revenue will be at stake as ACC reps work to re-sign existing sponsors while also trying to recruit at least four new partners. The conference currently has eight corporate sponsors: BB&T, Food Lion, Pepsi, Gatorade, Geico, AT&T, Toyota, and Havoline. The first five of those deals expire this summer at the conclusion of the ACC's current media deal with Raycom Sports. A sixth sponsorship deal, AT&T's, will expire at the end of the calendar year. Sponsors often wait until after the ACC tournament to get into the nitty-gritty of renewal negotiations, says Wyatt Hicks, Vice President of Marketing for ACC Properties, the business end of the conference. But he says, I think we're in a real good position in regards to obtaining renewals. One of the sponsors that Hicks will be wooing is Winston-Salem-based BB&T. The bank signed on as a sponsor just last year, but it was a short-term deal with an extension option due to the expiration of the television contract, Hicks says. BB&T's Mary Tolbert says the AC&C partnership is a good fit for the bank because the bank has a branch presence in most of the league's markets and many of its clients are fans or graduates. The ACC brand is a respected, valuable one, Tolbert writes. We do not enter into a relationship such as this without giving it a lot of thought. We expect this to be a long-term relationship. The ACC sponsorship deals typically range from $1 million to $2 million per year, with the amount of television commercial buys primarily driving the price differences, says Hicks. For that amount of coin, sponsors get TV advertising, tickets to use in promotions, signage opportunities, the ability to hold promotional events, and other benefits. ACC Properties, which is run by Charlotte-based Raycom Sports, collects the revenue from those deals. In turn, it pays the ACC a rights fee for the opportunity to sell the sponsorships. In today's world, there is a great importance for corporate support within intercollegiate athletics, says ACC Commissioner John Swofford. The ACC's corporate partners are a tremendous asset to the league and our member institutions, and we are proud to be associated with such a quality group. In addition to trying to re-sign as many of the existing sponsors as possible, or land replacements in their respective categories, ACC Properties executives are working to add sponsors for four additional categories. If successful, that would bring the total number of corporate sponsorships to a dozen. Nine is the most sponsors the league has had before at any one time. Sponsorship categories the league is looking to add include domestic auto, quick service restaurant, and airline. While no sponsor for those categories is currently on board, Chick-fil-A, Chrysler Jeep, and Continental Airlines have been league sponsors in the past. Even though the ACC's new 12-year, $1.86 billion television deal is with ABC ESPN, the contract is structured in a way that will enable Raycom to continue to market the corporate sponsorships. In addition to the main sponsorships, Raycom is looking at other ways to increase revenue, such as by offering limited sponsorships at a lower cost. Gary Stevenson, a local sports business insider who previously worked as a principal with Wasserman Media Group, LLC, says that one of the keys for sponsorship is to understand who they are targeting before they strike a deal. Sports historically gives a great return on investment if the program is well designed and executed, he says. Still on the front page, at the bottom of the fold, Tear Science rolling out dry eye treatment in Canada and Europe, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Morrisville. Tier Science in Morrisville, developer of a medical device designed to combat a common condition that causes dry eye disease, is riding the momentum of a $44.5 million fundraiser that closed in May 2010. The company expects to roll out full marketing of its dry eye treatment device in Europe and in Canada by the end of this year, and is seeking approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to sell its LipiFlow technology in the United States. With a staff count now nearing 30, the company has signed a lease to move and expand its office and research space into about 25,000 square feet in a building with expansion options at Perimeter Park in Morrisville, enough to accommodate as many as 60 workers. Tier Science targets the estimated $100 million people worldwide suffering from evaporative dry eye conditions caused by a lack of oil, or lipids produced inside the eyelid that prevent rapid evaporation of tears. If the eyelid glands are clogged or damaged, tears can become thick and cause the eye to feel dry. I would say that probably 50% of my patients have some type of dry eye conditions, and 25% of my day is talking about dry eye and treatment for it, says Raleigh optometrist Alicia Barnes. Barnes says she currently recommends that patients with dry eye complaints take pharmaceutical-grade fish oil to help loosen oils in the oil glands. She may also describe lubricating drops, warm compresses, lid scrubs, and in more severe cases, steroid drops for inflammation or prescription Restasis eye drops. But the hardest thing about treatment of dry eye is patient compliance, says Barnes, who adds that she is not familiar with Tear Science's technology. OcuSoft has goggles that heat up and help, but it's cumbersome. Technically, there is no cure for dry eye. Tear Science executives don't claim they have a cure for dry eye, but they say their studies have shown that their device may only require one or two uses per year to be effective. Tear Science was founded in 2005. Its technology is based on research started by Boston optometrist and dry eye researcher Donald Korb, says Tear Science co-founder and CEO Tim Willis. In all, the company has raised about $60 million from several blue-chip investors, such as Quaker BioVentures, Essex Woodlands Health Ventures, and DeNovo Ventures. We're seeing a lot of companies working on lipid replacements, and several small startups are looking at different ways of addressing the issue. But fortunately, we've not seen a lot of competitors with devices like this, Willis says. Tear Science's LipiFlow is an outpatient procedure that takes about 30 minutes to administer in a doctor's office. It's not painful, which surprises a lot of people, says Willis. He says the company has 6 beta sites in Canada and Europe, where Tear Science is evaluating its pricing structure and training procedures for eye doctors who purchase the system. Later this year, we hope to put the pedal to the metal and go to commercialization, he says. Willis wouldn't reveal the price of the product, but industry insiders say the device could cost an eye care professional about $80,000 to purchase. The patient cost would be $700 to $750 per treatment. It all depends on what happens with our FDA clearance, Willis says. We will add a few more job positions in 2011, and if we get clearance, we'll be adding quite a few more. Tear Science will locate this summer to the 5151 McCrimmon Drive building in Perimeter Park. It will occupy space formerly leased to AAI Pharma, which vacated about 60,000 square feet in the building after filing for bankruptcy protection, says Jeff Sheehan, Senior Vice President of Perimeter Park Developer, Duke Realty Corp. We're slowly refilling all that space with some young, exciting companies, Sheehan says. Now for the lead article off the front page, Namaste, India, Duke Exploring Campus and Growing Nation, by Jason DeBruin. From Durham. To further establish itself in one of the world's fastest-growing economies, Duke University is looking to build or otherwise establish a permanent campus in India. The Durham University already offers educational programs in India, but rents hotel suites to use as classrooms, says Dan McCleary, Director of Program Strategy and Interim Regional Director for India at the Fuqua School of Business, which established one of Duke's first programs in the Asian nation. In some cases, Duke rents an entire floor of a hotel. Program leaders replace beds with desks to establish a classroom setting and transforms suites into team rooms for students. It works, but it isn't as effective as having a facility that actually has a classroom with AV equipment and designated team rooms, McCleary says. It's not necessarily the perfect educational model. School leaders want a permanent physical presence in India, which might come as a partnership with an existing school or as an entirely new capital project through a partnership with a developer, says McCleary. India is one of the most dynamic and increasingly influential economies in the world, Michael Schoenfeld says. Schoenfeld made clear that decision makers are keeping their options open as far as location type or investment in India. You can't just walk in and announce you're doing something without a fair amount of research in advance, he said, but added that Duke University ultimately wants a permanent and visible presence in India. Standing in the way of any immediate capital projects, however, is a bill in the Indian Parliament seeking to regulate the entry and operation of foreign educational institutions, according to PRS Legislative Research, an Indian company that provides analysis on parliamentary bills. India is a very complex and complicated and still evolving location for higher education, Schoenfeld says. Right now, there are pretty firm regulations on what foreign universities can do in India. Essentially, the bill would regulate entry to make sure only the best foreign institutions set up shop in India. One of the provisions would mandate that a university set up a corpus fund with at least 75% of its income going toward the development of the institution in India. McCleary actually sees the bill as a positive for Duke. We feel this is an advantageous for us, says, because Duke is viewed as a top-level educational operation, he says. The bill, entitled Foreign Educational Institutions Regulation for Entry and Operations Bill 2010, was introduced a year ago. It would establish a way for foreign universities to expand in India and allow the Indian government to regulate them to prevent the entry of universities of dubious quality, according to the Indian government's Information Bureau. The bill still faces committee scrutiny before it will be taken up by the full parliament, says Tansuri Basu, a researcher with PRS. Duke officials are watching with a keen eye. If there is some change in the Indian law, we would certainly be interested in exploring future options there, Schoenfeld says, adding that there has already been an intense discussion and debate about the bill. Already, Duke touts its relationships in India. The university has 384 students and 87 faculty and staff from India and has 432 alumni living there, according to the school. The Fuqua School of Business by itself has 272 students in the Duke MBA Cross-Continent program. Of those, 117 students finished classes in December and will be graduated this year, while 155 will go to India next month, finish classes this year, and graduate in May 2012, says Chris Privett of the Fuqua School of Business. In February, Medanta, a conglomeration of specialty institutes in Gurgaon, India, led by medical practitioners and Duke Medicine, agreed to form the Medanta Duke Research Institute, MDRI, as a joint venture company in India, with the creation of an early phase clinical research facility at Medanta. Next up, inside the front cover, venturing for credit. Purdue wants TAC perk ceiling raised. By Chris Basden, from Raleigh. The job creation effectiveness of a state tax credit aimed at angel investors has declined dramatically over the past couple of years, a development that could hinder Governor Beverly Perdue's effort to boost the cap on the program by $2 million. A total of 304 jobs were created by investments in businesses registered with a qualified business tax credit program in 2010, according to data collected by the Office of the North Carolina Secretary of State. That was down slightly from the 314 recorded in 2009, but down more than 50% compared to the 706 that were notched in 2008. Average wages for jobs created by the program clocked in at $32,783 in 2010. The program has a ceiling of $7.5 million, meaning that the total amount of credits granted statewide each year can't surpass that figure. That has happened before, and investors had to settle for smaller percentage of the credits that they'd apply for. The uncertainty is a problem for entrepreneurs trying to entice angels. That makes it trickier to promote, says Stuart Schnantz, a director at Morrisville software startup Polyglot Systems, which has used the tax credit in fundraising pitches in the past. Purdue's budget proposal includes a provision that would increase the cap on the program by $2 million. Glenn Kaplan, a Robinson Bradshaw attorney who represents startups, thinks that's a good idea, though such an increase may go nowhere given the budget-cutting mood of the General Assembly. That would disappoint Kaplan, who says anything to further incentivize sophisticated angel investors to put their money to work to help fund emerging growth companies is something that should be encouraged. The program, which traces its origins to the 1990s, was started as a way to encourage the flow of venture capital to North Carolina firms, says Jeff Davenport, an administrative officer in the Personal Taxes Division of the North Carolina Department of Revenue. Davenport, who reviews applications for the program, says it allows investors and registered companies to receive a credit for 25% of their investment up to a maximum of $50,000 per individual. For a company to be registered under the Qualified Business Venture Program, it must be under $5 million in annual revenue and cannot be engaged in these industries: professional services, contracting or construction, selling or leasing at retail, entertainment or recreation, or managing or operating real estate. There are two other smaller elements of the program: a qualified grantee business and a qualified licensee business program. The last time the program's job creation number slipped as low as in 2010 was in 1996, when just 277 jobs were created, and the high point was 1,320 jobs created in 2001. The information provided by the Secretary of State's office did not include jobs data for 2002. George Cheater, a spokesman for the Secretary of State's office, says no studies have been done on why the numbers go up or down. But Kaplan, the attorney, says the economic downturn caused angel financing to slow significantly. That reflected in program data provided by the Department of Revenue. According to DOR, investors applied for $9.4 million in qualified business investment tax credits in 2008. That dropped to $5 million in 2009 and to $4.5 million in 2010. While the numbers may have gone down, entrepreneurs still see value in the program. It certainly has helped in talking to investors, says Bennett Love, a vice president at Serenica Pharmaceuticals, a Chapel Hill startup. Serenica raised about $300,000 in an angel round in December. That round included a handful of non-management investors who are based in the state. Love says the tax credit helps startup companies' executives in their pitches to investors because it can help mitigate the risk that angels face. He says his company's successful fundraiser led to the creation of 3 jobs. Currently, more than 100 entities have registered to participate in the program as either qualified business ventures or qualified grantee businesses. The registration dates range from the 1990s to 2011 and include local firms such as Durham's Regado Biosciences Incorporated, Morrisville's Neuronex Incorporated, Durham's Slate Pharmaceuticals, and Durham's Zenf Sound Innovations Incorporated. Next up, Tracking Beers from Brewery to Belly by Monica Chin. From Raleigh, Budweiser, Stella Artois, Highland, Natty Green. These and dozens of other brands of beer, wine, and other beverages line the alcoholic beverages aisle at grocery stores. So how to figure out what's selling and why? Enter Intervolve Incorporated, a 12-year-old Raleigh company that provides software to beverage distributors to help them keep track of sales data and manage distribution. On the backs of software offering businesses intelligence analytics in a niche market, in addition to achieving the blessing of giant Anheuser-Busch InBev in 2010, Intervolve doubled revenue in the past year and boosted staffing from 30 employees to 40 employees. To fund future growth, the company recently closed on a $5.98 million its largest round of financing to date, raised from existing investors and a venture capital firm. In 2011, the company plans to add functionality to its software and increase headcount by 25%. The recent rapid growth of the corporation suggests we are acquiring a larger percentage of market share, says CEO William Kaluza. The fact that we can now relate that some of the largest distributors in the country are our customers creates a sense of enthusiasm on the future of the company. The company has two main products that are Windows-based: Distribution Suite, which provides business intelligence analytics on sales, and Route Accounting System, a distribution of software. The growth of Intervolve has been helped in part by the growth of the beer industry in North Carolina, particularly by craft brewers, which are adding to the variety of products wholesalers carry and the amount of data that they have to manage, which means they have more need for Intervolve's products. Rick Craig, Vice President of Operations for R.H. Behringer Distribution Company, a wholesaler in Greensboro, says the company overhauled its distribution and sales from a paper-based system to Intervolve's software in 2006. Since that time, Craig says, the number of suppliers to the company has gone from one, Anheuser-Busch, before its merger with InBev, to a total of 90. The company now sells 700 products that range from international brands to the locally brewed Natty Green. The consumer's interest in a variety has driven an explosion in the number of products and suppliers that now occupy the marketplace, Craig says. Craig also says Intervolve has a niche in business intelligence that isn't met by the likes of Microsoft or SAP. Alcohol regulations vary state to state, so what Intervolve can do for us is different from what's needed in a company in, say, South Carolina, he says. Tim Kent, director of North Carolina Beer and Wine Wholesalers Association, says craft beers comprise only 5% of the consumer market, but the segment is growing. The wine industry in the state is also growing, he says. But Kent points out that while the variety of products is expanding, the number of wholesalers and beverage companies is shrinking through consolidations, leading to larger distributors dominating the market. In 2008, St. Louis-based Anheuser-Busch merged with InBev, a 645-year-old company from Belgium that counts Stella Artois and Beck's among its brands. Partly as a result of that merger, Kaluza and others say distributors were encouraged to consolidate as well. Kaluza says he believes that means distributors will need more advanced software. Intervolve software now is used by 2 of the 10 largest distributors in the country, he says. We listen to feedback from customers about functionality they needed in their particular operations, Kaluza says. When we add that for a distributor, that's one of the largest in the country. Typically, everyone else can benefit from it. Saeed Poole call on court to fend off lender, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh. Owners of the One Renaissance office building in North Raleigh have filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in an admitted effort to preempt what they say are aggressive takeover tactics by the building's lender. Waste Industry CEO Vin Poole and DeWitt Real Estate Services owner Todd Saeed together built the 165,000-square-foot building to serve as the headquarters of both of their companies and leased out the remaining space to other businesses. One Renaissance was built in 1999, and it has a tax value of almost $24 million, according to Wake County records. When the building's $17 million loan principal came due in mid-February, Saeed says the special servicer hired by Wells Fargo Bank to manage the loan just got very aggressive. Saeed says he and Poole had already found another lender willing to refinance all the building's debt within the next 30 days, but he says the special servicer was unwilling to accept any negotiations and allow us more time. Special servicer CW Capital Asset Management of Bethesda, Maryland, has assigned Raleigh lawyer Barry Mann to serve as a substitute trustee for the One Renaissance property off Wake Forest Road, according to Wake County records. Poole says CW Capital was preparing to appoint a receiver for the property, which would have taken negotiating power away from Saeed and him as owners. We were dealing in good faith, but once a receiver is appointed, your value drops and it's harder to refinance, Poole says. That's what the bankruptcy court is for. It keeps unreasonable lenders from damaging owners' assets. According to commercial mortgage data company TREP LLC, the U.S. delinquency rate for loans and commercial mortgage-backed securities, such as the loan for One Renaissance, rose to 9.4% in February, the highest in history. The value of delinquent loans now exceeds $61.8 billion. New Bern bankruptcy lawyer Trawick Buzzy Stubbs says he is starting to see more cases such as One Renaissance in which property owners are at odds with their lenders because balloon payments have come due or they can't find a buyer for their property. It's a cash flow problem, Stubbs says. They have value in the assets, but they can't sell as fast as the creditors want the money. Wake Forest developer Jim Adams also has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection for two of his multi-million dollar properties in North Carolina because land sale activity hasn't kept pace with his mortgage bills. The economy has crushed us, says Adams. There's nothing you can do to keep all of these projects going. Over the last several years, Adams and his partners have acquired more than 7,400 acres of land in the Triangle and in Pamlico and Hyde counties for future development, timber sales, and investment. In February, Adams filed for bankruptcy protection for a 2,200-acre hunting reserve and pine plantation called Makapunga that he owns in rural Hyde County. He was planning to build a log clubhouse and sell memberships to the hunting club, but now he's fighting for time to sell enough timber and land to cover his $2.9 million debt to Ag Carolina Financial. Adams also was working through a deal in bankruptcy court to repay investors and creditors who backed him on the purchase of 250 acres in Granville County, where he was planning to build a residential and commercial development called Highland Trails. Next up, Franklin Street Fund of Funds tops $500 million in assets, by Monica Chin. From Chapel Hill, Franklin Street Partners' largest fund of funds project, the Franklin Street Multi-Strategy Fund, can now claim assets in excess of $500 million. Federal filings filed in late February under two separate entities, a limited partnership and a limited liability corporation, show the Chapel Hill hedge fund clocked in at $430.3 million and $70.6 million, respectively. The Multi-Strategy Fund was started in 2002 with initial size of $101 million and $9.8 million. Investments were solicited in the United States and Puerto Rico for a minimum stake of $500,000. Requests for comment to Franklin Street Partners gained no response, but hedge fund industry watchers say funds of funds, or FOFs, which are diversified portfolios of hedge funds, have been attracting investors' interest during the recession because they pose a lower risk. At the end of third quarter 2010, FOFs, investments in hedge funds, made up an estimated $920.1 billion of the $2.4 trillion hedge fund industry, according to hedgefund.net. Total FOFs assets under management increased by $33.5 billion in 2010, with investors putting $5.3 billion into the funds by October. With the financial crisis, there was an increased interest in liquidity options, and fund-of-funds seemed more attractive, says Mikyu Cho, an analyst with HedgeFund.net. HedgeFund.net, a hedge fund news website that compiles hedge fund data as reported by the fund managers themselves, lists Franklin Street Multi-Strategy Fund as having $515 million in assets. Average annual return for the fund has been 5.3%. Although it lost 20.5% in 2008, it bounced back with an 18.9% gain in 2009. Estimated annual return in 2010 is 6.2%. Campbell Harvey, a professor at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, who has served as a consultant to and principal of asset management firms, says there has been an increasing appetite for investing in hedge funds as a result of uncertainties in other parts of the economy. Given that equities are risky, given that bonds are risky, people are going to naturally look for alternatives, Harvey says. FOFs offer safer investment opportunities than traditional hedge funds because they are a more diversified form of investment, but often with higher fees. Still, according to HedgeFund.net, investor interest in fund-to-funds cooled between 2009 and 2010. In a report in June 2009, FOFs accounted for 48.4% of the hedge fund industry. By October 2010, however, that had declined to 38.2%. And now, Pappas Investment Golden, with return as much as 14 times, by Jason DeBrun, from Durham. When California pharmaceutical company Plexxikon struck a deal to be sold to a Japanese company for more than $900 million, the announcement was met with silence all over the triangle, except probably inside the office of Pappas Ventures, a venture capital firm in Durham. Well, that's because Pappas's 7% stake in the company, represented by an investment of $4.7 million, suddenly was worth as much as $65.5 million. In a statement worthy of being described as understatement, Emily Mendel of the National Venture Capital Association says, clearly, this is a home run for the venture investors. It's not like it never happens, but it's a small percentage. Here's how the deal breaks down. Plexxikon will get $805 million in upfront payments from Tokyo-based Dachai Senko Limited. The company will get an additional $130 million if Plexxikon's melanoma-fighting drug candidate called PLX-4032 is approved for sale. If the drug is not approved, Pappas gets $56.4 million instead of $65.5 million. At the top end, Pappas's return would be nearly 14 times its original stake. For context, only 18 of 109 venture capital transactions in 2010 returned 10 times the investment, according to National Venture Capital Association. Whatever the eventual return, it will represent a solid payday for Pappas investors. Pappas invested in Plexxikon in 2002, meaning it stayed with the company longer than the average of about 5 years. The investment came in the B round from the groups Fund 2 and Fund 4. In 2010, venture capital groups invested only $13.9 billion, which was small, Mendel says, and returns such as those enjoyed by the Plexxikon investors could spark a willingness investors groups to get back in the game. Going forward, Mendel says she expects to see more deals that have these favorable returns. A year-end NVCA survey found that more than 81% of VCs and CEOs expect more acquisitions in 2011 compared to 2010. The economy is indeed recovering, Mendel says. The centerpiece for the Plexxikon deal is the melanoma-fighting PLX-4032. Plexxikon and Roche, the drug's co-developer, will file a new drug application later this year, and the company executives are hopeful. It will receive approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, says Susan Kincaid, spokeswoman for Plexxikon. Pappas Ventures focuses its investments in life sciences. Firm founder and leader Art Pappas, a veteran of 30 years in the life sciences sector, both as an executive and venture capitalist, referred questions to partner Ford S. Worthy. Melanoma patients urgently need effective therapy, and we're hopeful that Plexxikon's drug will ultimately be approved so it can benefit these patients, says Worthy. Next up, bank takeover by feds, purchased by First Citizens, rouse board. Raleigh Bank acquired Denver Institution and Acquisition Engineered in 2010 by regulators. By Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. First Citizens Bank, which has been making regulator-assisted bank acquisitions since 2009, will play the role of interested bystander in an ongoing legal tussle stemming from its fifth and latest deal. Federal regulators closed Denver, Colorado-based United Western Bank on January 20, 2010, and turned to First Citizens to assume roughly $2 billion in loans and deposits and take ownership of the troubled community lender. Now the former board members of the Colorado Bank claim the seizure was an abuse of power and unnecessary in a federal lawsuit filed against two regulatory agencies. They want the bank's assets returned to them. It's the first out-and-out challenge of the regulatory powers of the Federal Office of Thrift Supervision, OTS, and the Federal Deposit of Insurance Corporation, FDIC, in recent memory. There have been earlier ones, lawsuits, says William Rubery, spokesman for the OTS, but this is the first since the financial crisis of 2008. Rubery added, "We had solid grounds in the United Western closing, and we will defend the lawsuit vigorously." First Citizens is not named as a defendant in the case, which will be heard by a federal judge in Washington, D.C. "Since the suit doesn't involve us, we have no comment," says First Citizens spokesman Barbara Thompson, adding that the bank continues to operate the 8 former United Western branch offices it took over. OTS was the Denver bank's primary regulator because United Western was set up as a federal savings bank. OTS also directed the January seizure, appointing the FDIC as receiver. The FDIC then signed the asset purchase deal with First Citizens. In the lawsuit, former United Western chairman Guy Gibson says the bank's holding company and common shareholders saw their equity stakes erased when the regulators descended. Contrary to the government's contention that the bank was illiquid, the suit says United Western had adequate cash, $403 million, to meet customers' needs and was closing in on a $200 million cash infusion when the seizure took place. The suit contends that the only reason the bank fell below being an adequately capitalized institution was because of an OTS-ordered asset write-down. In addition to those points, at issue before the court will be a long-running disagreement between the OTS and the former United Western managers over which of the bank's deposits were put there by cash brokers and which by commercial customers. FDIC spokesman David Barr says the agency doesn't comment on current legal matters. Prior challenges to the agency's authority back in the 1980s reaffirmed the FDIC's regulatory powers, he added. Using its well-capitalized position, First Citizens has partnered with the FDIC in a series of 4 failed bank acquisitions before the early 2011 United Western deal. Not counting the Denver deal, the prior transactions have brought First Citizens 49 additional branch offices in prime markets in California, Washington State, Florida, and elsewhere, more than $6 billion in additional loans and deposits, and federal guarantees against excessive losses. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the philanthropy news desk of Todd Cohen, Extraordinary Ventures puts people to work. On a typical day in a former office building on South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill, workers can be found setting up for events, vacuuming, sweeping, arranging tables and chairs, cleaning windows, and making coffee. The facility is operated by Extraordinary Ventures, a nonprofit created by 2 fathers, Greg Ireland and Mark Roth, whose sons are autistic. And the workers doing the setup task all have autism or developmental disabilities. The nonprofit, founded by Ireland and Roth in 2007 to provide employment to people with disabilities, handled roughly 654 events last year that drew roughly 1,000 people a week to the facility. Those events generate over half the nonprofit's annual operating budget of roughly $300,000. Extraordinary Ventures, which employs a full-time staff of 4 people, also operates a laundry business it launched in September 2010. That business offers a fluff-and-fold service to groups and individuals, including students at UNC Chapel Hill. Its main client so far is PTA Thrift Store, with the nonprofit on a pro bono basis cleaning cloth donated to the thrift store for sale to the public. In addition to the 25 people with disabilities, Extraordinary Ventures employs on its payroll, the nonprofit also works with 20 students with disabilities referred by local high schools. Kelly Lucer, event director for Extraordinary Ventures, says business is booming after 2 years of renovating the building and trying to figure out how to set up and run the event center. Rented from one of the organization's founders, the building includes a 3,000-square-foot room that handles most of the events. "We do pretty much everything," Lucer says. The nonprofit, which serves people with autism, muscular dystrophy, mental retardation, and developmental disabilities, provides training for its client employees and volunteers, many of whom bring their own job coaches provided by the state through other agencies. For its new laundry business, Extraordinary Ventures markets itself to UNC students through networking events and flyers, with client employees and volunteers picking up laundry, washing and drying it in the nonprofit's machines, and folding and delivering it to customers. That business so far generates only a tiny share of the organization's budget, with events generating over half and the rest coming from contributions and grants. Foundations supporting the organization include Stroud Roses, a private foundation in Chapel Hill, the Mary Duke Biddle Foundation in Durham, and CVS Caremark. In addition to putting client employees and volunteers to work, Extraordinary Ventures provides them with training on interviewing for a job, workplace behavior, and other soft work skills. Lucer says the group also provides social events for its clients, including dances, the second and fourth Friday of each month, that are staffed by volunteers, often from fraternities and sororities at UNC. It also offers classes on topics like weightlifting or dance, and in the summer the nonprofit takes clients to Hyco Lake near Roxborough for water activities. We not only put people with disabilities to work, Lucer says, but we also try to provide the best services for the community. Next up, NCSU researchers may have stumbled on curb for cancer. I want to emphasize that this is in the very early stages, says researcher Nanette Nescon-Yoder. By Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. While studying the origins of intestinal birth defects, researchers at North Carolina State University believe they might have found a way to stop the growth and spread of cancerous tumors. Nanette Nescon-Yoder, an assistant professor of molecular biomedical sciences, typically researches birth defects, particularly in the gastrointestinal tract. During a screening of chemical compounds of one such study that used frog embryos, she and associate chemistry professor Alex Dieters discovered a compound that induced heterotaxia, a disordering or mirror image flipping of internal organs, according to a report published in the February 24th issue of Chemistry and Biology. The researchers dubbed the compound heterotaxin and found that it has other effects, particularly as it might relate to tumors in humans. They determined that the pathway most likely to be affected by the heterotaxin was the TGF-beta pathway, which is known to play a role in the progression of cancerous tumors. This was exciting because tumors have to have cells that can migrate and form a blood supply in order for the cancer to spread, Nescon-Yoder said. Heterotaxin inhibits those processes, which may make it a good lead candidate for the development of an anti-tumor drug. The researchers made clear that they are only in the beginning stages of determining the compound's efficiency and have tested it only in petri dishes. They do not know what specific effect it could have on humans at this point. Could they have a big impact? It's possible, NC State Associate Professor of Oncology Marlene Huck says. On the other hand, there could be downside to the way the compound is currently structured. For example, it could be too toxic to benefit humans, Hawk notes. They may be able to devise a drug that has the impact we want without the toxicity, she says. I want to emphasize that this is in the very early stages, Nescon-Yoder said. Still, at least in a petri dish, experiments with Hawk and cell biologist Philip Sands showed the heterotaxin quenches the growth of canine tumor cells and inhibits some of the changes required for human tumor cells to become migratory and invasive, according to the published report. Dieters developed new chemistry in his NC State lab to synthesize the chemical structures used in the biological experiments. He says the compound itself, or a derivative of it, could become a new drug, or it could be used as a tool in conjunction with other components to discover new anti-cancer drugs. On a more personal level, the researchers say they enjoyed working together partly because their fields of research are typically separate. Our worlds don't overlap that much, Hawk says. This was a fun project, honestly. For Nescon-Yoder, the collaboration helped lead to the new discovery. The little, tiny eureka moments always lead to more questions, she says. You call up your colleagues and do experiments, and then you finally get it together. And now money matters for small business. A bells and whistles business. Companies outfit first responders with their equipment and vehicles. By Chris Basden. From Youngsville. Face it, a lot of folks want their vehicle tricked out. From nice rims and a spoiler to a rockin' sound system, there's nothing better than cruising down the highway in a customized ride like Vin Diesel drove in The Fast and the Furious. Normal cars aren't a problem, of course. Plenty of shops cater to those. What do you do if you're an emergency medical technician who needs his ambulance tricked out not with nitrous oxide but with oxygen mask and defibrillators? That's where the folks at Youngsville-based Southeastern Emergency Equipment and West Jefferson-based Southeastern Specialty Vehicles come into the picture. These sister companies sell medical equipment and vehicles, including ambulances and fire trucks, to first responders, meaning they market some of the most eye-catching merchandise you can imagine. Our whole business is pretty cool, says SEE President Carla Baker. We've got flashing lights and things that shock you. Donald Pleasance founded SEE more than 30 years ago. He still owns the company, and he and his daughter, Nikki Pleasance Mullen, co-own the vehicle company. As their names imply, the firms do business all over the Southeast and as far afield as Texas and Pennsylvania. The equipment company employs about 40 people, while the vehicle firm has about 23 workers. Annual revenue for the combined companies is in the range of $40 to $45 million. The companies are distributors. They do not manufacture the items they sell. SEE's product list includes everything from bandages to backboards, surgical collars, and heart monitors. With a product list so diverse, it's no surprise that prices can range from as low as 25 cents to as high as $25,000. While EMS personnel and firefighters are SEE's core customers, the firm has diversified in the past decade or so. About 20 to 25% of its business now comes from selling emergency medical equipment to clients such as corporations, churches, and golf courses, and training them on how to use the products. Clients include the likes of Pepsi Bottling Ventures in Raleigh, Durham County EMS, and Johnston County Ambulance Service. They gave us an excellent work product, says JAS Jeff White. They're very easy to work with. Tim Edwards, who handles medical logistics for Wake County EMS, said the companies offer competitive prices. But what he really likes is the fact that a lot of the SEE reps have been EMTs. Not all of their competitors' sales reps can boast of such insider experience. A lot of people try to fake it, says Edwards. After a while, you can see through it. Baker, a former EMT and paramedic, knows that relationships are important. While the company has recently begun embracing online sales, she's aware that the personal touch is what gets and sets SEE apart. We never intend to get rid of our feet on the street, she says. We will never, ever be a strictly e-commerce company. And now an article about family business by James Lee. Discord is inevitable, but it can be lessened. We've worked together for more than 15 years and never had an argument. On the credibility scale, that statement ranks right down there with the check is in the mail and I promise you I won't quote you. Differences and disagreements at some level between family members in business together are virtually inevitable. The constant contact in both work and family settings and the difficulty of separating business relationships from family relationships are just two of the factors that can bring feelings to a boil in family-owned companies. But there are ways to keep disagreements from exploding into conflict. Here are five of them. 1. Talk openly and often. Communication is still the most effective conflict preventive in family business. People who say what's on their minds in a non-confrontational way, who ask honest questions and give honest answers, and who say thanks and good job seldom get into trouble with one another. Every family-owned business should have at least one family staff meeting per week and encourage lots of open exchanges of views and information in between. Playing the cards close to the vest is good poker, but very poor family business management. 2. Let bygones be bygones. The kid who snatched toys away from his little brother is now a 35-year-old corporate vice president. The rookie salesperson who miscalculated the price on her first big order is now the director of marketing. Families sometimes have trouble seeing one another in real time, in the present. They hang on to childhood characterizations and early family memories. The best way to avoid family business conflict that's based on yesterday's miscues and affronts is to grow up, get over them, and move on. 3. Put in professional policies and procedures. Make realistic long-range plans, set targets and target dates, adopt written policies and procedures, and stick to them. Running loose might be okay for a happy little mom-and-pop business that's only about $2 in the black at the end of every month. But when a family company grows, it has to be operated in a business-like fashion as a serious commercial enterprise with plans, policies, and controls. Taking cash out of the cash register for coffee might not be such a big deal. But financing a personal automobile or a real estate investment with company funds is a big deal, especially when it fires up a family feud over issues of fairness and equity. Running the family business with professionalism, integrity, and transparency will help keep down the misunderstanding and grumbling that can often erupt into open warfare. 4. Keep the payouts in proportion to the inputs. Maybe performance-based compensation is a classier way of describing this tactic. An investor who puts up 10% of the startup capital shouldn't walk away with 50% of the profits. Similarly, a family executive who contributes a minimal effort to the business's success shouldn't be rewarded with a big chunk of the proceeds of that success. Most family businesses make some special provision for sharing the benefits of ownership among family members. But in a business that allows a few family members to take away shares of the benefits that are way out of proportion to their inputs and contributions can become the setting for hand-to-hand combat. 5. Families in business will always have some points of disagreement among themselves, so disagree with respect. We live in complex times, and families are no longer the closed, homogeneous units they once were. Family members may seem to one another to make diverse life choices, marry strange people, or raise their kids in oddball ways. To prevent such natural differences from becoming bones of contention, make a family policy of respecting the life choices and points of view of brothers and sisters, parents, offspring, and other family members. Agreeing to disagree with respect will help avoid a lot of unnecessary conflict in the family and in the business. Are your kids expressing an interest in becoming a veterinarian? Well, that's good. We could use more folks helping a man's furry and four-legged friend. Then again, it's a problem if little Johnny wants to get all operational Fido with a reciprocating saw and duct tape bandages. Fortunately, there's a solution that can encourage Junior's career ambitions and keep Peta off your back. Take the kids over to Marble's Kids Museum, which will open a pet vet exhibit on March 19th. The exhibit, which is sponsored by Banfield Pet Hospital, features a kid-sized vet clinic with exam tables, kennels, and the like. Kids can read x-rays, check the vital signs of stuffed animals, and run around in doctor coats. The family dog will thank you. Golfers, quick, what's a dormy? Well, in olden days in Scotland, the word was used by Scots when they neared the end of their lives. I'm a dormy then meant someone had reached the point where their life had become calm and tranquil. After the Scots invented golf, the term came to be used to mean a golfer that had reached an insurmountable lead in match play. Fast forward now and to North Carolina. Marketing has begun for the first new golf course to be opened in the Pinehurst area since 1996, and it's called the Dormy Club. The course was designed by Ben Corr and Ben Crenshaw, the same team that just wrapped up design changes to Pinehurst No. 2. With the Dormy Club, the developers say they're offering a dormy atmosphere for their members, not just good golf, but also a lifestyle of serenity and health and wellness. The Dormy Course is a walking layout about 5 miles north of Pinehurst. Situated on 300 acres, it features 100-foot elevation changes and two natural lakes with no housing or roadways. Features include reachable par fours, wind tunnels, and a 241-yard reverse par three. There's a new entrant in the fields of diabetes and obesity drugs. Michael Gray, a venture partner with Durham-based Pappas Ventures, has invested in a new company called Lumina Pharmaceuticals that he co-founded with Bruslavina Guaidin, formerly with San Diego-based Amylin Pharmaceuticals. Guaidin is co-founder of Satogen Pharmaceuticals in San Diego, which has discovered metabolic mechanisms that can be targets for type 2 diabetes and obesity, bypassing systemically absorbed drugs or invasive surgical methods. Satogen has a licensing deal with Lumina. Lumina, which is just about a month old, has $250,000 in funding to start, according to a U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission filing. The company will be honing its financing and development plan for the next few months. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the TBJ will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.